still give, but I don't care for gold. What use is money when you need someone to hold? Don't have direction, I'm just rolling down this road, waiting for you to bring me in from out the cold. You'll never know.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. It's WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and it's Living Writers. Today, Chloe Benjamin is here in the studio. We're taping 15th of January, 2018. Chloe, thanks so much for rushing to the station from the airport.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so sorry about the delay.
It's, well, the weather, right?
I know.
You're safely. That's the main thing.
Yes.
And you're actually, fortuitously, we've got like a whole list of, you're on in the midst of a tour here.
Yes.
For your novel, The Immortalists. How's
yes.
it going? How's
It's going well. It's crazy, but it's wonderful. I mean, I've never done anything like this. And so it's kind of like flight in the morning and then event later in the day. And this is actually the first time that there's been any kind of travel delay. So I'm glad for that, although sad for us. but it's amazing. I mean, it's such an incredible thing to be able to tour like this these days.
Yes, because this is the Immortalists is your second novel.
Yes.
Out with Putnam. And let's see, you know what? I'm going to start with the bio in the back, just as we usually do, Chloe, and then
sure.
we'll settle in. Chloe Benjamin is the author of the novel The Anatomy of Dreams, which received the Edna Ferber Fiction Book Award and was longlisted for the 2014 Center for Fiction First Novel Prize. A San Francisco native, Benjamin is a graduate of Vassar College and of the University of Wisconsin, where she received her MFA in fiction. She lives with her husband in Madison, Wisconsin. So you're used to the cold.
I am. It feels like coming back home. We landed. It looked frigid. I was like, yeah, here I am back in the Midwest.
Right. And so did you ever expect to be sort of more rooted in the Midwest growing up in San Francisco? And
no, I totally didn't. You're right. I'm from San Francisco, born and raised. My family's still there. And I moved to the Midwest for graduate school for my MFA in fiction. And I just totally fell in love with it. I call myself a born again Midwesterner. I just think it's the quality of life is great. There's just kind of a slightly different ethos than when you're in a big city. Like the first time that somebody started chatting with me on the bus, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be killed. And now I'm the person who's like, how's your day? So I really love it here. I mean, San Francisco will always have my heart, but the Midwest has been a really great home for me.
It sounds like it has maybe part of your heart.
It
already.
Does. Oh, for sure. For sure. It's divided. Yeah.
well, let's talk about the novel then. Do you mind giving us sort of an idea of the, like, so we're not giving anything away, but yeah.
Yeah. So my little nutshell is that the book opens in 1969. Four siblings growing up on the Lower East Side of New York have heard of the arrival of a mysterious woman who claims to be able to tell anyone the date that they will die. So these siblings go to her and they receive their prophecies. And then the book follows each of them individually over the course of their lives. And it looks at the way that fate and chance and expectation shape our futures.
That's some nutshell. That's really something. So how did were you just walking around and this idea hit you? Like, what's the origin story of the Immortalists? Was it one of the characters? Was it Faya?
You know, I think it was just a lot of subconscious stuff that bubbled up that comes out of my own psychology and neuroses.
Right.
More than
the writer.
Yeah. You know, more than any like specific light bulb moment. It's actually hard for me to remember exactly when or where I had the idea. I know that it was always these four siblings going to the fortune teller, and then the structure was always there for me from the beginning of following each of them over the course of their lives. But I heard this great quote a couple days ago, and I think it's from Stephen King, that a lot of the rest is kind of like the guys in the basement, like the, you know, whatever aspects of your mind are working below the surface, behind the scenes. So as a feminist, I amend that to the gals in the basement. But I just thought Amen. That was such a I thought that was such a great point, because, you know, I always wish I had a better answer to that question, but it's kind of mysterious to me too.
Well, that's so, but writing is mystery, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, let's see, do you know the quote by Donald Barthelme? Writing is a process of dealing with not knowing, a forcing of what and how.
That's great. I love that.
Because that idea of not knowing.
Yeah.
In life, you know, that's kind of life as well.
Yeah.
Right? But I think reading through like the coping with uncertainty.
Oh, yeah.
Or so,
absolutely. I mean, that's such a great quote. I'm going to have to remember that one, because that to me is really the heart of the book. It's less, you know, the sort of more sensational question of if you knew when you would die, how you would live, and more about how to cope with the inherent uncertainty of life, that we have to make decisions about the future without knowing how long we have in the world, which in itself is kind of a psychological magic trick. And then, and, you know, learning how to love without, you know, with the specter of loss as always being a possibility. So those things are, I mean, that's the neuroses that I was mentioning. That's where the psychology comes in. And it's funny, my dad was, I said, this is what I often say in response to that question. My dad was like, I don't think you should say that. It makes you sound like kind of off, or like you have problems. And I'm like, but we all do, you know, like I don't feel too vulnerable sharing it, because I think if somebody says they don't think about this stuff at all, like they're lying. Or maybe there are just people out there in the world who have it figured out, and I want to know their secrets.
Yeah. But, well, I'm not sure what they have figured out.
Yeah, it's true.
Might be something, but maybe it's something better we don't know. I don't know. Because it does feel like it's the nature of living and
mm-hmm.
loving.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book is also about family.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's very much a story about siblings, and about adult siblings in particular, which is a dynamic that I wish I saw explored more in fiction. For me, adult siblings and the relationships that they have are really moving, because you have this intimacy with your siblings from the time that you were children, but a lot of us don't know our siblings as well as we know our friends in adulthood. Of course, there are some people who are really close to their brothers or sisters as adults, but I think a lot of us, you know, you have this historical shared memory, but you also have a lot of contradictory memories, and you have a lot of differences despite having grown up in the same petri dish. So that was all rattling around as I wrote the book, for sure.
And I suppose also with your oldest character, with Varya,
yeah.
With her heading into the sciences mm-hmm. as well to study aging
mm-hmm.
or so, I guess you had a time to sort of think about the process of, I don't know, more about the scientific angle as well.
Yeah.
And the story, or in the whole larger frame.
I think that the story, or I think that the novel looks at a few different belief systems as ways of coping with mortality. For one character, that's magical thinking. So others find solace in religion. And Varya, the eldest, is really, she's really focused on science, although at the same time, she also has some really irrational beliefs that contradict with the way that she'd like to think of herself as somebody who really is pretty cut and dry.
Well, having gone to a fortune teller at 13.
Yeah.
That would sort of set your course in also another direction.
Yeah.
Which seems somewhat anti-science.
It's true. So I think she really feels that struggle in herself. And at the same time, she's trying to use the tools that she has available to her from this perspective of biology to extend the human lifespan. And so there's something about that that's almost like absurd and magical and irrational in and of itself, even as we're also seeing that it is happening. Like it is, you know, to some extent, we are starting to live longer lives. Scientists are always kind of chasing at the tail end of disease and figuring out how to, you know, cure or prevent that. Of course, death continues to win out, as I suspect it always will. But those are some of the things that she's grappling with.
And so it sounds like you just have such a warmth when you're talking about the characters, oh, your characters.
I do. I really love them. And I haven't always felt, I haven't ever felt this attached to characters. I really, and I think that comes through on the page. Like, I've heard people say that people feel really attached to the characters as well, and they really connect emotionally with them. And I think that that comes because I do too. So, I mean, of course, I'm conscious of the hubris of saying things like that. Like, it's like so ridiculous, and it takes some ego to be like, yeah, these people that I made up, I just love them so much, you know.
Well, I didn't hear it that way.
Well, good. But, you know, there's this bizarre thing about writing where, like, you hope that it will resonate with other people and bring them solace and companionship, but it's your creative work, and asking somebody to read that and become invested in it is a big ask. So I'm conscious of both of the sides of that.
Well, it seems like you're also a writer that writes to make it, believable. So it might be a big ask, but what you're trying to do is create the world, even cinematically. Like, I'm thinking of a moment where we meet all four of the siblings, and they're in the bunk room, and we know where the cat is on the radiator in the patch of light.
Right.
We can kind of see them. So there's this careful world building that's giving us what we need to see that shows us more, which I think is this, not moving too fast through that, which shows tenderness, I think, as well. Mm. I don't know. Is that, and also then beautiful lyrical language. And I love on your website how you actually have a page started where you're my favorite lines or lines I love. And,
Yeah, I started this favorite sentences page on my website because I always feel like I'll see something that I love and I'll underline it, but then you don't really, you might not remember it. So, you know, as somebody who's kind of worried about loss, it was a way to collect them all together. And that's so beautiful, that what you described about the setup of that room. And I can tell you're a writer yourself, because am I correct that you went through the MFA here? Yeah, so I'm... Like, that's such a insightful way of putting it. And I do think I see things cinematically when I write. Like, I have some training, or I did as a young person, in theater and
dance.
Yeah, and dance. And so I see things very cinematically, and I'm very focused on blocking, which is a theater term for, you know, as someone is talking, what are they doing with their body? Do they cross the room? Do they pick up a drink? Like, not just having it be dialogue that's kind of disembodied. So I think that contributes, I hope, to a feeling of immersiveness in the writing.
I think it does. And that quality of, like, you can believe it because you're being welcomed into it somehow.
Oh, that's so nice. I hope so. Those are the books that I love. Like, I just came, I've been trying to think about how to describe, like, the books that I want to find, and immersive is the best word for it. Like, I love atmosphere. And for me, so, you know, I'm from San Francisco, so I love fog and rain and drizzle. And, like, I love Tana French. She has these mysteries set in Dublin that are just, I don't know. I don't know exactly what creates immersiveness. I think another great example is the Harry Potter books, you know, kind of different, very different category. But there's something about those books where the world feels so rich and detailed and alive. And when I think that's why they have such power, because people truly feel like they are inside them. Like, I remember I was growing up roughly along with Harry.
So as they, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember being like, my letter's coming, you know, from the owl, and I'm going to go to school. And so I think that there's, you know, that, like, that is what grabs me, and those kinds of epics, I guess.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk more. Today on the program, Chloe Benjamin is here. Her novel, The Immortalists. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we've got River and Andrew behind the glass. We'll be back.
I should mention Michelle. the summer. It's like a merry-go-round. I see you under the midnight, all shackles and bows. High shoes with the cleats clicking, a temperamental glow.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Chloe Benjamin is here, The Immortalist, the novel on the table before us. It is such also not to be superficial, but judging a book by its cover, but it's a beautiful book.
It
even
is.
Sparkles, Chloe.
I know.
How the heck
did such
you,
a great job
how did
it.
You get this to happen? Like, oh. What kind of magic did you work?
It's all the credit goes to Putnam. I mean, there's a wonderful artist, Sandra Chu, who works for them in their art department. And I'm so glad to hear you say that. I don't think it's superficial at all. I think books are beautiful objects, and that's why we hold on to them. I mean, of course, the stories inside are, you know, the main thing, but like that's why I don't have an e-reader. You know, and I don't knock anyone who does. I think like whatever works for you. I'm so glad that people are reading. But yeah, I love it, too. And I've gotten so many good comments on it. And I just feel really happy that it feels like a cover that doesn't exclude any readership. Like it doesn't feel age specific. It doesn't feel gender specific. I really like the universal feel of it.
Oh, completely. And did you get to help? Like, were there choices and you were able to kind of keep those things in mind, Chloe?
Yeah.
And then choose accordingly? Like, yeah. Be drawn to it?
We went through a few different options. And I think once we got to this one, we all kind of felt like, okay, this is the right direction. And so it was a collaborative process. And I just love my publisher. I will sing their praises till the cows come home. I think that they're just fantastic. And so they were really great about, you know, hearing my input and incorporating that.
Well, and it's a tree in different colors under a night sky.
Yeah, we should probably tell people what we're talking about.
I just realized that I'm here gazing at it.
Yeah.
And The Immortalist, when did that, since we're on the cover here, when did that title like come to you as what you wanted for these?
You know what? I
characters?
Don't remember when that was, but I think it was very early. I mean, that was always, as far back as I can remember, that was the title on my folder, on my computer. And I don't say this self-deprecatingly. I'm serious. I'm really bad at titles. Like, I really struggle with them.
Hard.
They're so hard. I have a friend who, she's a poet. I think poets are good at titles. But she has just a great brain for them. And whenever I have a good one, I'm just so relieved. And I felt like this was it. And it also, it has a few different valences. Obviously, it's sort of a cheeky nod to the impossibility of being immortal. But one of the characters in the book grows up to be a magician. And so her act is called The Immortalist. And so it also kind of ties in with that.
With Clara.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's actually why we chose the song by The Cars to play too.
That was
break.
So good. Oh my gosh. I love it. See, I should have thought of that. I'm so bad with this stuff.
Maybe for the rest of your tour, you can like, as you come on stage, you can
just
have.
Yeah. Or like the one that's like, it's magic, you know. You know,
yeah.
There's actually a lot of good, like, or like, what's like The Loving Spoon? Didn't they have a song that was like, do you believe in magic?
That's,
now they're all coming to me.
Oh my gosh.
Me.
Yes. Oh my
Michelle
gosh.
Michelle, like we were trying so hard to think, or I was. So yeah, all the magic songs.
Well, you know what? If we have any time at the back end of the show, we'll throw some of the magic songs
awesome.
On there. So we'll just compile
Love it.
Them. Okay. Do you mind reading something for us so we
Not
can
at all.
Get a sense of the
yeah.
prose? And, okay.
So as I mentioned, the book opens with these four siblings going to the fortune teller. And then at the end of the prologue, the prologue follows them, get their prophecies, and then it skips into the future and follows each of the siblings individually. So I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from the prologue as they are walking through the neighborhood of the Lower East Side. Again, it's 1969, and they're on their way to see this woman. They wind through the neighborhood, all four of them. Varya, the eldest, Daniel, 11, Clara, 9, and Simon, 7. Daniel leads the way, taking them down Clinton to Delancey, turning left at Forsyth. They walk the perimeter of Sarah D. Roosevelt Park, keeping to the shade beneath the trees. At night, the park turns rowdy, but on this Tuesday morning, there are only a few clumps of young people sleeping off the previous weekend's protests, their cheeks pressed to the grass. At Hester, the siblings become quiet. Here they must pass Gold's Tailor and Dressmaking, which their father owns, and though it is not likely he'll see them, Saul works with total absorption, as if what he is sewing is not the hem of a man's pant leg, but the fabric of the universe. He is still a threat to the magic of this muggy July day and its precarious, trembling object, which they have come to Hester Street to find. Though Simon is the youngest, he's quick. He wears a pair of handed-down jean shorts from Daniel, which fit Daniel at the same age but sag around Simon's narrow waist. In one hand, he carries a drawstring bag made of a chinoiserie fabric. Inside, dollar bills rustle and coins shimmy their tin music. "Where is this place?" he asks. "I think it's right here," Daniel says. They look up at the old building, at the zigzag of the fire escapes and the dark rectangular windows of the fifth floor, where the person they have come to see is said to reside.
Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you.
And so, and who is this person? Because she reappears.
Yeah. So the person is a fortune teller. She comes from an ethnic group called the Romani, who have told fortunes for centuries and have faced persecution and oppression for it throughout the world. They've been a very mobile population and are often referred to as gypsies, although that's a term that many feel is derogatory. So you learn more about her as the book goes on, but to them, she is the woman. And I wanted to explore how this person is both sought after for her gifts and also reviled for them.
Why did you want to explore that?
Well, Chloe, I think there's this trope of, you know, the powerful, all-knowing woman or the witch or, you know, a woman that seems to have something precious and special and different about her. And there's a way in which that attracts people, and there's a way in which that also results in prejudice or persecution.
It threatens them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that we see that archetype in a lot of different stories. And it was important to me to later on in the book give this woman a little bit of time to speak for herself. So you see that further on in.
Okay. Because I was wondering with this scene, I was wondering what you wanted us, because your characters, each of them have like we were talking about earlier, there's a tenderness to them. Like there's a complexity. No one's just this way or that way. Or, and so in this scene, there's definitely a moment where she's with the first with Varya and kind of gripping her, like pinching her as Varya is leaving, and there's a coldness that then Varya says, like, you know, let me go or something. And so it made me wonder what you did want us to know there in that moment, or maybe about what we were supposed to feel like, because it felt sort of, it did feel chilling to me as a reader, this moment. And then these kids are worried.
Yeah.
You know, it's clear. I hope.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that it is sort of a shocking moment to Varya, and she responds coldly. But I also think that what the fortune teller is doing there, I mean, she says, and this isn't giving much away because it's all in the prologue, but she says, like, she's trying to reassure the character. And so she is really trying to get her attention and say, you know, things are going to work out okay for you, because she could tell that the child is alarmed. And So to me, that's a benevolent instinct on the fortune teller's part. So, yeah, I hope that people see in her character a complexity, and that they feel for her as well. I certainly do, but I also wanted to show how the characters in the book view her, and some of them don't view her positively.
Right. And so also feels like there's a strong, because she's a female character as well, like there's a strong female character presence and portraying like obstacle, like things that are true for like that women have to deal with from, and is that also, I don't know, is that something important? Like, was it in your subconscious, like in the gals in the basement? Like, do you think that's part of sort of like what the story wants as well? Like to kind of explore these women's lives, and because we're going across generations, right? We even learn about Clara Senior as a vaudevillian. I don't know. Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, oh, I absolutely do. And I think that was conscious. I mean, I'm passionate about women's rights and about feminism. And I think that you see each generation of women in the book struggling with different things. But then a lot of them also struggle with the same things. So Gertie, the mother of these four siblings, she was, you know, she had to leave college where she was on scholarship when she became pregnant. And, you know, as much as she loves her children, I think she's always felt that she didn't get to fulfill her potential. And so she really pushes her children and her daughters in that direction. And Clara, one of her daughters, the one who wants to become a magician, she isn't academically minded. That's not what she wants. But she actually has more similarities with her mother than she might expect, because as a woman in the field of magic, it's incredibly difficult to make your way. Female magicians have always been few in number. Women are most often relegated to the role of assistants, and, you know, they're sort of the pretty body in peril. So I certainly wanted to track how those stereotypes and barriers persisted throughout the time frames of each of these characters.
And so it sounds like you also, regarding the magic, for example, you did a lot of research then.
Because
these are probably not, well, I don't know. Did you have magic?
I mean, I'm sure
you have magic in your background, but maybe not stage magic.
No, I mean, each section required a ton of research, and they were all very, very different. And, you know, each one has a different time period that it's set in, many of which I haven't lived through myself, or a different geographical setting, a different profession that each of the siblings have. So each section was quite a lot of research, which is really important to me to make sure that I'm portraying things I haven't experienced with as much integrity as possible.
And for you as a writer, is that something you do, Chloe? Like, is it part of your, like when you're imagining a story and into this story, is that part of how you kind of tick? Is that what your first novel was like too?
My first novel had a lot of research as well. That was in the realm of dreams and lucid dreaming. I think I'm a fiction writer. I'm not a memoirist or a nonfiction writer, and so that means I'm writing about things that I haven't necessarily experienced. And so to do that well, I think it's just incumbent on me to do research for any of those things. But certainly this book took a lot, like anything I've done is a lot of research, but this takes the cake, I think.
How so?
Well, just that it's divided into these four sections, one of which follows a different sibling, or each of which follows a different sibling. And it's kind of like four, in a sense, it's like four novellas in one. So, you know, they're each, like I said, a totally different setting and time period and profession. And so all of those took a lot of individual research.
So to keep a handle on that, like, do you like lay things out visually on the wall, like maps or?
No, I tend to research as I go along. So like I wasn't doing the research for the fourth section while I was writing the prologue or the first section, because I just can't keep everything in my head. I find research really inspiring, though, so I do it while I kind of research until I feel like I can start writing, and then I keep researching and I keep writing, and I kind of go back and forth. I mean, I certainly take notes very extensively, so that helps me to keep track of things. But it's a little overwhelming and a little stressful sometimes. But I think, you know, if a project doesn't scare me, I feel it's hard for it to hold my attention over as many years as they generally take.
If a project doesn't scare you.
Right. Like it, if it doesn't scare me, it like it doesn't feel big enough or exciting enough to, yeah, to grab me for that long.
So there's the writing tip for the day. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Today on Living Writers, Chloe Benjamin is here. We've got Reverend Andrew Engineering. We've got Michelle Pernia as our studio audience. I'm T. Hetzel. We're glad you're listening. Back soon.
Wanna be a man, one, lorang, lorang, you dang, you dang.
We got him, King Louie!
Yeah, man, we got him!
So you're the man cub. Crazy.
I'm not as crazy as you are. Put me down! You cut that out!
Cool it, boy. Unwind yourself. Do 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 do. Now come on, let's shake, cousin.
What do you want me for?
Word has grabbed my royal ear. Have a banana. That you want to stay in the jungle.
Stay in the jungle? I sure do.
Good. And old King Louis, ba do ba ba do. That's me. Can fix it for you.
Well, welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. It's Living Writers. Today on the program, Chloe Benjamin is here, her novel, The Immortalist. Chloe, I'm hoping this can be part one of another longer conversation.
Sure.
So we can maybe have one some future time. Because I also love the title of The Anatomy of Dreams, too. What's your current project now? Like, are you working on some things sort of milling around in your mind?
I am. It's, you know, I'm sure it won't surprise you that I'm too superstitious to say anything about the new project.
But I'm working on it.
You know, it's
silly still, question of mine.
No, not at all. I'm honored that you asked. But it's another ambitious one. And so right now I'm mad at it. So I'm giving it the silent treatment, but I'm going to pull through.
And you're just doing a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
So to keep your mind off of it.
Yeah.
And that's great. Well, Chloe, thanks so much for talking today, stopping by the station. And I look forward to our next conversation.
I do too.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Today on the program, Chloe Benjamin, The Immortalist. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time. And I guess next time sometimes comes sooner than we think. you've still got Living Writers. And for the second half of the show, we decided today not to do more songs about magic and connected to Chloe Benjamin's amazing book, the novel, The Immortalist. But today we're going to think about, like, talk a little bit about community, some stuff that's happening close to home, starting with tonight. Friend of the show, Raymond McDaniel's reading at Literati. He'll be reading from his new collection, The Cataracts, at 7 p.m. So that's tonight at Literati Bookstore at 124 East Washington Street. Raymond McDaniel, friend of the show. I've got his latest book here. And so we'll be hearing a couple of poems a little bit later in the program of Ray's. I also wanted to mention the amazing opportunity to hear Claudia Rankine and P. Call tomorrow. The keynote event and Penny Stamp speaker series continues. A conversation with Claudia Rankine and P. Carl. Theater Matters, Activism, Imagination, Citizenship. And this event is tomorrow, Thursday, January 18th, just after 5 at the Michigan Theater. Later in the program, we'll be hearing a piece by Claudia Rankin, her video essay. We'll be hearing the audio track from Situation 7, which she made with John Lucas. But first, Raymond McDaniel and two poems from his new collection, out now, hot off the press, Coffee House Press. The first poem is called Vertumnal. And a thanks again to Ray for picking these two poems for me to read today on the program. Vertumnal. Vertumnus, god of gardens, a whom out of a what. From dirt I declare I can make anything. The quartz and loam and severed insects, the gourds and grasses, up from dirt, the hares and the dogs and the men who can run down neither hares nor dogs, yet somehow manage to kill and eat both. Of dirt all these, in quadrants exhibited, I declare all outdoors my garden. Glass it in, I threaten, but with water and light. My garden will grow and die and grow by dying and thus subsist forever and ever. In the garden stands the thing that stands for human, to scare away hares and dogs, to be the garden's god. Only a man would look for a god in grass and see a man. The dog runs for the hare and the rabbit runs from the dog, one for its dinner and the other for its life. But a man just stands and attributes himself to God. The search for Vertumnus reveals the rendering, then the God rendered, and only then the renderer. That was, I just saw Stephanie, who's engineering today. She mouthed through the glass. That was beautiful. And it was. Raymond McDaniel, everybody, from his latest book, just out with Coffee House Press, The Cataracts. Okay, we've got one more poem on deck, everybody. Hope everyone's keeping warm out there. This poem is called Hot House. Not to rub it in, though. But anyway, hope you guys are warm out there. Okay, by Raymond McDaniel, Hot House. A rose, rose, a violet, violet, a jade, jade. No, the architecture of each a refusal. Rose is not rose, nor violet, violet, nor jade, jade. But each is what it is, not what it seems. What each seems is what of each gets seen, though what we see isn't the thing seen. The petals of the rose are violet and jade. Thus the petals of the rose look to us rose. The shape of the violet absorbs all but violet. The violet we see is the violet a violet rejects. A rose is a rose is a rose, but not as a rose. Jade is the name of jade, not the jade named. And that was a poem, Hot House, by Raymond McDaniel, from his new book, The Cataracts, just out with Coffee House Press. So tonight, you can go and see Raymond McDaniel launched The Cataracts, his latest book, out into the world at Literati Bookstore, 124 East Washington Street. And also a quick note, Ray is just a wonderful, he's a spectacular reader. And so you should go. I know it's cold out there, but you should go. And for every copy of Cataracts that's ordered or bought tonight or ordered through Literati, Ray McDaniel will be donating $2 to the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. I'm just going to take a moment to tell you what this is from their website. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition is committed to removing Florida's civil rights ban, which is imposed on citizens with past felony convictions. Florida is one of only three states that strip all individuals with past felony convictions of their civil rights, including their fundamental right to vote, even after completion of their sentences. So this organization, again, is called the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, and Ray McDaniel is going to, for every book purchased at Literati Bookstore tonight and ever after. For every book purchased, The Cataracts by Raymond McDaniel, he'll donate $2 towards this fund, this cause. So tonight at Literati, 7 p.m., Raymond McDaniel. When Living Writers returns, we will hear Situation 7 by Claudia Rankine with John Lucas. But let's take a short break now.
Baby,
oh yeah,
baby, yeah.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're tuning in. And if you're just joining us today, we've had Chloe Benjamin on the program with her novel, The Immortalists. And two poems from Raymond McDaniel's new book of poetry, The Cataracts. And Ray will be speaking, will be reading poems tonight and talking about them at Literati Bookstore at 7. And tomorrow, I mean, we've got so many great things happening in Ann Arbor. Tomorrow, Claudia Rankin is going to be part of the Penny Stamps Speaker Series. And it's also the keynote event in No Safety Net, Opportunities to Engage through UMS. And she'll be speaking. There'll be a conversation with Claudia Rankin and P. Carl called Theater Matters, Activism, Imagination, Citizenship. And I can't think of a better time than right now for this conversation with Claudia Rankin and P. Carl. So anyway, and that's Theater Matters, Activism, Imagination, Citizenship. So this afternoon on Living Writers, we're going to play a video essay. I know, it's a video essay, but we're playing the audio track, which is great. And I hope you think so too. That was published in Tri-Quarterly, the online journal version of Tri-Quarterly, on Tuesday, January 20th, 2015. So a couple of years back in time, but almost to the day, in issue 147 of Tri-Quarterly. So this is called Situation 7, and this is Claudia Rankin working with John Lucas.
On the train, the woman standing makes you understand there are no seats available. And in fact, there is one. Is the woman getting off at the next stop? No. She would rather stand all the way to Union Station. The space next to the man is a pause in a conversation you are suddenly rushing to fill. You step quickly over the woman's fear, a fear she shares. You let her have it. The man doesn't acknowledge you as you sit down because the man knows more about the unoccupied seat than you do. For him, you imagine it is more like breath than wonder. He has had to think about it so much, he wouldn't call it thought. When another passenger leaves his seat and the standing woman sits, you glance over at the man. He is gazing out the window into what looks like darkness. You sit next to the man on the train, bus, in the plane, waiting room, anywhere he would be forsaken. You put your body there in proximity to, adjacent to, alongside, within. You don't speak unless you are spoken to. And your body speaks to the space you fill, and you keep trying to fill it, except the space belongs to the body of the man next to you, not to you. Where he goes, the space follows him. If the man left his seat before Union Station, you would simply be a person in a seat on the train. You would cease to struggle against the unoccupied seat. When, where, why, the space won't lose its meaning. You imagine if the man spoke to you, he would say, "It's okay, I'm okay. You don't need to sit here. You don't need to sit," and you sit and look past him into the darkness the train is moving through, a tunnel. All the while the darkness allows you to look at him. Does he feel you looking at him? You suspect so. What does suspicion mean? What does suspicion do? The soft gray-green of your cotton coat touches the sleeve of him. You are shoulder to shoulder, though standing you could feel shadowed. You sit to repair whom? Who? You erase that thought. And it might be too late for that. It might forever be too late or too early. The train moves too fast for your eyes to adjust to anything beyond the man, the window, the tiled tunnel, its slit darkness. Occasionally a white light flickers by like a displaced sound. From across the aisle tracks room harbor world, a woman asks a man in the rows ahead if he would mind switching seats. She wishes to sit with her daughter or son. You hear, but you don't hear. You can't see. It's then the man next to you turns to you. And as if from inside your own head, you agree that if anyone asks you to move, you'll tell them, "We are traveling as a family."
We just heard Situation 7 by Claudia Rankine and John Lucas. You can find that online at Tri-Quarterly. You can also find the text for this piece in Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, an American Lyric, out with Grey Wolf Press. So tomorrow night, a conversation with Claudia Rankine and P. Carl, Theater Matters, Activism, Imagination, Citizenship, as the keynote event and Penny Stamp's speaker series, Michigan Theater, 5:10 p.m. Tonight, more poetry is in the air. We've got Raymond McDaniel at Literati Bookstore at 7 p.m. for his book launch and reading. So that's Raymond McDaniel's book launch for The Cataracts tonight at Literati at 7 p.m. So I'd like to say a big thanks to Stephanie for engineering today and bearing with me through all the pieces and parts of this one, and to Sarah and Sarah Min for their help with like the song choices, and many thanks to Reverend Andrew for of course taping and engineering on Monday with Chloe Benjamin. So check out the Living Writers Instagram to see some photos and some news and such. And Google Living Writers to find our website with the super long address. Just Google Living Writers and you'll find our website and with a growing archive of all the shows. So I'll say goodbye for now. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time.
I have a request. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. Oh. Southern trees bear strange fruit. blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rock, for the tree to drop. Here is a stream and bitter crop.
Hello and welcome. The DSR.
Living Writers is like gotta be the worst show on like the airwaves.
But then all my power rankings.
Oh yeah, man.
The 27th. But you will remember me
for centuries. Takes the snap, takes the handoff to Smith, rolling to his right, still looking for a receiver. Breaks through a tackle and he's got a seam down the sideline. Touchdown, Michigan. Gardner takes the shotgun snap, looks to his right and connects. Reaching for the end zone, touchdown Michigan, Amara Darba. Gardner makes the handoff to Smith, looking, firing. Jake Buck, one-handed catch. He caught it. Unbelievable catch.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Sports Report on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. That's 88.3. Thank you for joining us for the Daily Sports Report today. My name is Peter Monahan.